Almost 50 years we've been on the air, and that's an amazing track record. There are very few radio stations like this around the nation. And you can show your support for KBOO by dropping by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and drop off a donation or contribution that way. Or if you don't have time for that, then pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. It's also very easy to donate online. Look us up on kboo.fm, and you can donate that way. It's discreet, quiet, and super quick.
It's actually not even a donation. Think of it as an investment.
That's right.
You're investing in your community radio. You have a stake in what happens here. You have a stake in the programming that we offer. You can become a volunteer here at the station when you become a member. And that gives you access to all kinds of training and programs. You can learn how to make radio yourself. And all of that happens with your financial support. 877-500-5266 or at KBOO.FM. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz and Will. Thank you for encouraging people to call and support community radio. And the time is 11 o'clock. It's time for the Recovery Zone. Stephanie Potter is waiting in the wings to speak with her guest, Elizabeth Whaling, author of Your Brain's Politics, Neuroscience and the Political Divide. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Let's listen to one announcement, and then we'll go to Stephanie Potter.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. The second annual Vanport Mosaic Festival will offer an exploration of the history and legacy of Vanport through a series of films and plays, lectures and conversations, and guided tours. Audiences will be invited to reflect upon the journeys of those who lived and died in the city of Vanport. As part of the festival, there will be screenings of a selection of Vanport oral histories. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland, your listener-supported community radio station, and I'm Stephanie Potter. And this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. In our world today, there seems to be a tremendous and growing split between the left and the right. And my guest today has co-authored a book to help make sense of that rift through an understanding of neuroscience and family dynamics. Elizabeth Whaling is a teacher and researcher at UC Berkeley in the Department of Linguistics and Cognitive Science. She is committed to research in language, thought, and ideology that fosters transparent democratic discourse and has written several books, including The Little Blue Book, co-authored with linguist George Lakoff, and most recently, also co-authored with Lakoff, Your Brain's Politics, How the Science of Mind Explains the Political Divide. And by the way, this book is available with just a $75 contribution to our KBOO pledge drive. All you have to do is call 1-510-860-9966. So after that, Elizabeth, I just want to welcome you. You're right here on the phone with us, right?
Yes, hello.
Hi. Hello. So I wanted to start with, I read online that you had made a bet with a colleague that Trump was going to win. Is that so?
That is true. So essentially what happened, well, do you want me to launch into an explanation or did
you? Yeah, well first of all, how much did you win?
I won $500.
You won $500. Yeah. Okay, so what made you so sure you had it in the bag?
So essentially, so what we did is one line of research that we are engaged in is looking at how people's reasoning about family values and the ideal type of parenting translates into their beliefs about ideal governance and what makes for good governance and what makes for bad governance. And what we know is that, roughly speaking, people who believe in strict families, where there is a strong emphasis on absolute authority of a strong father figure and rules and punishment, etc., that such people tend to endorse more conservative standpoints. And that, on the other hand, people who have nurturant family values, who believe that the best type of parenting is to foster empathy, cooperation, and individual as well as social responsibility in children through modeling all these things on the political arena translates into more progressive viewpoints. That being said, before the election, we took a bunch of voters who were still really undecided should they vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and we gauged their family values. And what we found is that those who were entirely strict in terms of family values were set on voting for Trump. And those who were entirely nurturant were set on voting for Clinton. However, about 30% of our participants in the middle, who were still undecided who to vote for, turned out to endorse both strict and nurturant family values. So they were ideologically flexible, if you want, to use either family model when reasoning about the political topics at the time and the presidential candidates. Now, what we did is we took these undecided voters, of whom we knew that they have both strict and nurturant values in their mind, and we catered to them different so-called framings. A framing is a linguistic realization of the worldview, if you want. So we gave them several different framings, either evoking strict family values or nurturing family values. And these undecided voters went all the way over to Trump whenever we talked about strict family values. However, if we gave them factual evidence, pro-Trump or pro-Clinton, they were not moved in the same way at all. So we gave them a little text like, we know from an independent team of researchers at some, you know, made-up university that with a Trump administration, we're going to see a huge downfall in the economy. And they wouldn't move. However, they moved significantly, strongly, when we talked about strict family values or nurturing family values. Now, in the next step, we took what we had done and we compared it to what both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were doing in their campaigns. And what we saw is that while Hillary Clinton did not talk extensively about nurturing values, like empathy, like social and individual responsibility, cooperation, and very tangible, strong images, Trump did exactly that, but for the strict family model. He talked about strictness, authority. He talked about following the rules. He talked about punishment, etc. And we had a word for him that was actually circulating, which was Big Daddy, right? So people were starting to talk about Big Daddy Trump. We saw Trump talk about a lot of those core ideas of the strict model. And so our best, so we knew from the laboratory, we knew from the lab that if these undecided voters are either reading about strict family values or nurturing family values, they immediately go toward the right or toward the left. And then looking at the campaigns that were being run, we said, okay, look, the best estimate we have here based on the data from the lab is that if the election campaigns continue in the way that they do right now, Trump is going to generate much more support because he talks about morality and values in a strict term, and all these ideologically flexible voters in the middle who endorse both strictness and nurturance in their everyday life are going to go and vote for him.
Wow.
And so that was the basis of my bet.
And it just totally, by the way, I want to let listeners know, I gave the wrong phone number. It's actually 503, let's see here. Oh boy, I've got it somewhere. Oh yeah. 877-500-5266. So anyway, that's the number to call. So, and we are going to be going right now to Liz and to Will to talk about this pledge drive. But this is like really fascinating to me how we cannot figure out, just with facts. It's like it really gets into a kind of a moral thing that people are into with how they vote. And I want to get more into that when we return. But Liz and Will, are you there? And can you help us help listeners support KBOO Radio?
Absolutely.
You bet we can. And Liz and I are here. My name's Will. And we also have many volunteers behind us who are eager to answer the phone. And that phone will start ringing when you pick it up and dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. We have the terrific book that Stephanie's talking about. It's about neuroscience and the language of politics and the politics of language. And you can get one of these books. There's only 5 available, so you want to snatch them up right now. And this is the last day of Pledge Drive. So call up, talk to one of our terrific volunteers, and dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. And you can also donate online. That's super simple, discreet, and very quick. Look us up on kboo.fm, and you'll see where to put the mouse thingy and the cursor and all that. I'm not very technological, I'm sorry. And then one of my favorites is come into KBOO. Be part of your community. Check out where your money goes.
Meet us in person.
Yeah, come in, have a cup of coffee, meet our receptionist. Some of them are lovely, some of them aren't so lovely, but they're here, and that's very important. And you can be part of this community by dialing 877-500-5266. Isn't that right, Liz?
That's right. Just before we get back to the show, I want to just mention thank you to 2 folks who donated online. Thanks to Holly from Southwest Portland.
Thank you, Holly.
Thanks to Stephanie from Northwest Portland, who says, thank you for helping to brighten my day and open my eyes to more injustices and inequalities that are happening in our community.
I remember when my mom said that to me. So what are you talking about? Take me out of the country.
Thanks, Stephanie and Holly. Thanks to everybody
who's
become a member already. And we're really anxious to thank you. And now we're going to go back to Stephanie's interview with Elizabeth Vailing.
Elizabeth, hi. Here we are again. And basically, what I got from just how you won your bet and is that we don't think in terms of facts, as you were saying. We think more in terms of, like, does this person agree with my morals, actually? And there is, you said, a huge split in our morals. But how does this, in terms of neuroscience, what is going on here exactly? I mean, why, these are actually like what I was getting from your book, structures in our brains that get developed when we're very, very young. And could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so first of all, you know, you just brought up in your question the issue of factual reasoning in politics versus moral reasoning in politics. And what we do see over and over and over again is that when people have to make a political decision, they do not look at the bare facts and come to some rational conclusion about the objective, quote-unquote, meaning of these facts, because most facts in politics don't have objective meaning. There is no way to think about them without morally contesting the issue. So whenever we look at a factual situation, let it be the environment, let it be labor, let it be immigration, we bring to the table, in order to attribute meaning to the facts, our very own ideological moral perspective. And because we have such different moral perspectives, we have a democratic battle over who should be running the country and how. I mean, the very reason that we have political battle is that there is in politics no all-encompassing general meaning that can be given to facts, right? So
yeah.
It's in the nature of politics, really, that politics is about morality. It's about the question, what's right and what's wrong? What's the best way to organize a community, a country, so that everybody is better off? And one person will tell you, well, everybody is better off if we have maximal competition and people need to try really hard to look after their self-interest, and by maximizing each individual's discipline in this way, we're going to maximize the well-being of society. And then another person will say, well, actually, in order for our society to be well off, we need to act on empathy. We need to take care of each other. We need to recognize that we each are equally human and in need or deserve to be taken care of, and that is the moral mandate of governance, and we do that via the public. So you immediately have these moral contestations come in whenever the question is raised, what is right and what is wrong in politics. And so the very idea that people factually think about any political issue, really any political issue, is already flawed. And so when you see election campaigns or any other moment of political communication just hammering away at the facts and being like, look, we have this fact and this, and we have so much unemployment and this many people without healthcare, etc., these numbers, statistics, and facts in and of themselves lack political meaning. The meaning comes in with the morality. And this is exactly what we see. And to get to the second part of your question, you said, well, how is the brain structured? How is our mind structured so that we arrive at these different moral contestations of what it means to be a good community? That has to do with very strong primary experiences early on in life with a number of different things from our real world experience. And let me give you the most relevant example for what we are talking about today. Our primary, our most tangible, our strongest experience with being part of a social in-group and having authorities run this social in-group is family. Family is our first and most salient experience with being governed and with belonging. And so because of this template that we learn early on in life, we end up later in life using this template to think about politics, because a nation and governance is so abstract. We have never seen the nation. We have never touched, smelled, heard, or in any other tangible way interacted with what a nation is or what governance is.
An abstract notion, you're saying. It's not a real something you can touch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so this all relates back to something called embodied cognition, which means that whenever our brain needs to think about something abstract that's out of reach for us, like literally out of reach for us, that we cannot directly perceive of, our brain turns to so-called conceptual metaphors to reason about the abstract thing. And the strongest conceptual metaphor when it comes to reasoning about good and bad governance is the family domain. And this is why we see these results over and over and over again in our research, that people do draw unconsciously, implicitly, on their family ideals to arrive at their political ideals.
And you actually said that, 98% of our reasoning is actually unconscious. I mean, that just seemed like such a huge number.
That sounds like such a huge number. And believe me, I mean, when I got into cognitive science many, many years ago, and I first heard this number, I was, you know, I said to myself, and I said, something must be wrong here.
Yeah.
And because, you know, when you and I say unconscious reasoning, we think of like fruity, you know, Freud. We think of like the unconscious that's somehow hidden and like makes us have certain behaviors and beliefs, etc. But we do not usually think of unconscious reasoning when we look at details like, what does the brain do? Like, let me give you a very clear example. When you read language that has to do with action, like, you know, John is grasping the fork, John is biting into the apple, John is kicking the ball. As you read the verbs, as you read the action, the linguistically encoded action, your brain in the premotor cortex, which is the area that plans motion, simulates what it would mean to move your hand, your jaw, your foot. So your brain understands language to a great extent by mimicking what's encoded in the language, by physically mimicking it. And that part of cognition, that part of language, is unconscious, right? If I say to you now, you know, you're reaching for the pen, mm-hmm. you would never ever would you get back to me and say, like, Elizabeth, I realize as you say this to me, I realize that my brain is actually planning motion. I just wanted to be clear about that, you know?
Right.
So these things just happen in the, you know, they happen behind the scenes, and they are part of unconscious reasoning. And so knowing little things like that makes you understand that, in fact, the very high number, the, you know, estimated 98% of reasoning that are unconscious, actually doesn't sound so high anymore, does it?
No, it's as you say, embodied cognition. And once again, we're going to Liz and Will to talk about KABU and how you can support KABU and you can support the ideas that KABU wants to disseminate, different ways of thinking and trying to understand what is going on with us, what is going on with our world, and how it all intersects. Will and Liz, are you there?
We are. We are. And the way you can support KABU and all of this amazing brain science is to pick up your phone and call 877-500-5266 or go online to KBOO.fm and become a member that way. This book sounds really fascinating. So Stephanie is speaking with Elizabeth Valen, who has written a recent book called Your Brain's Politics, How the Science of Mind Explains the Political Divide. And she co-authored this book with George Lakoff. And you can receive a copy of this book for a $75 membership contribution. $75 is a lot of money to come up with all at once, but it comes out to just $6.25 a month.
That's affordable.
That's very affordable. And we only have 5 copies. So take a moment right now and pick up this fascinating book, 877-500-5266. You know, I think it's really interesting that we're talking about the way our brains may influence our moral choices, that there are like neurochemical and biochemical things happening in our brains that influence the moral choices that we make as well as the political choices that we make. And I'd like to learn more about that personally. But more to the point, this is the only radio station where you're going to hear anything like this kind of conversation. The unique programming that we hear on KABU, on Stephanie's show, The Recovery Zone. Stephanie, how many years have you been on the air doing this show?
Oh, I think about like a decade with The Recovery Zone, and maybe since 2004 at KABU.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Stephanie has been bringing you these really interesting perspectives on how our brains work and how we can use our own physical and emotional and spiritual potential to do more good in the world and bring healing to the world. And today we're talking from a more scientific point of view about what happens in your brain and how that influences your decision-making process. So ask yourself, what's happening in your brain right now? Tell your brain to go to your phone and pick up 877-500-5266 and support this unique programming that you won't hear anywhere else, this unique locally produced program here at your community radio station, KBOO.FM.
That's right. Just pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KABU. It's incredibly important. And KABU feeds your head. I mean, this information, you won't find anywhere else. It's all about the neuroscience. That's right. And food costs money. We all know that. So pick up the phone, contribute to pay for this head food? I don't know if that sounds right. But anyway, dial 877-500-5266. It's 877-500-KABU. It's incredibly important to keep this wonderful media resource on the air. Fox TV doesn't need us to doesn't need you to donate. NPR doesn't need you to donate, but I probably shouldn't mention that. But KABU does. We run on a shoestring budget, but even shoestrings cost money. So please pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. You can also donate online. That's super simple. I'm not going to try and explain it because I don't really understand it.
But that's what our intrepid phone volunteers are here for, and they
that's
are just
right.
waiting to take your call.
Yeah, so I'm a bit of a Luddite, so I recommend using the phone. It's simple. It's been around a long time, and we have people waiting to answer the phone. And when it rings, we'll ding that bell and thank you. And why not pick up our hoodie? We've been emphasizing the hoodie. It's super cool, $25 a month, and it's yours.
It's black. It's zip-up. It's got the KABU logo emblazoned on the front.
The radical KABU logo.
Left breast. And it's Ooh. Warm, and it's a great way for you to feel warm and cozy and protected, and also to support your local community radio station. It's a win-win. What are you waiting for? 877-500-5266. Speaking of thanking people and ringing bells, We have Kent from North Portland, who is a renewing member. Let's hear it for Kent.
Kent.
Yay, Kent. Thank you so much. And we've had actually a lot of people to thank this morning. We've had an incredible run of calls, and we'd like to continue that because today is the last day of our spring membership drive. So this is your opportunity. If you've been putting it off or saying, oh, I'll get to it eventually, this is your last opportunity to show your support for your community radio station in spring 2017. And we do have a fair amount of money that we need to raise, but we don't need to have one person raise it all by themselves.
That's
so, for
right.
example, 80% of our operating budget comes from individual contributions of $5 a month or $10 a month or $25 a month. So whatever amount you can afford, you decide what that is. Put a financial value on KABU. What does it mean to you to hear this programming? And then call us and become a member. Invest in your community radio, 877-500-5266. Will?
Use your wallet to prove what you find important. And also, if you get the really cool hoodie, you can prove you're a better anarchist than the next person. And isn't that important? So please pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. Let's keep these volunteers here really busy. We know you care about the radio station. That's why you're listening. Show your support. Contribute right now. It's very important. This is the last day of Pledge Drive. I'm asking you to dial 877-500-5266, and now back to Stephanie.
Thanks.
Okay, Elizabeth, here we are again. I guess I'm sort of intrigued again, too, though, with the actual neuroscience differences of left-wing brains and right-wing brains. And I know you've done studies, for instance, on, like there's actual emotional reactions that are very different in terms of disgust or anxiety or the need for order. And could you talk a little about some of the research you've done there that and what you've learned?
Absolutely. So let's take disgust as a really good example. We all have, again, a conceptual metaphor. I already mentioned a moment ago what conceptual metaphors are. Conceptual metaphor means to take an everyday tangible experience to reason about something that's more abstract. Now, if you think about the question of right and wrong, the question of morality, that's actually a somewhat abstract thing to reason about. So we have about a dozen of metaphors to think about right and wrong, about good and bad. We have being good as being upright, like somebody is an upright person. We have being good is light, right? So we speak of the dark history of a country, etc. So we have a bunch of metaphors to think about good and bad. And one of the most potent metaphors to think about good and bad is that good is pure and bad is impure. And linguistic realizations of this metaphor would be things like somebody has dirty thoughts, somebody has a clean conscience, etc. We need to clean up in this country, etc. So there's a lot of language that we all use in everyday, you know, conversation and thought to think about what good and bad is in terms of physical purity. Now, this metaphor is used also in political discourse, and one of the things we see that it tends to come up much more in conservative discourse. There's been behavioral evidence that conservatives do care more about cleanliness and purity, and now what we did is we took it to the brain. So we took what we knew from discourses and from behavior, and we took it to the brain, and we asked the question, well, if you put conservatives and liberals into a brain scan and you give them political statements that use this metaphor to make politics understandable, how do they react, and do they react differently? And what we saw is this. First of all, if you have somebody in the brain scan and give them the sentence, tax relief is a disgusting idea, then the brain of the participant simulates physical disgust. So the same brain areas are active as if you were smelling something really, really abhorrent, or seeing an image of somebody throwing up, or seeing an image of a festering wound. So the same brain area that's responsible for computing actual physical disgust gets activated when you read about metaphoric disgust, like tax relief is disgusting. Now, when you take literal language instead of the metaphorical language and you say something like the tax relief is a bad idea, that same region is not active at all. So nothing similar by any means happens in the brain. So we know that the disgust language is very potent for political reasoning in general. And then we took the next step and we said, well, let's look at differences between the conservative brain and the liberal brain. And what we found is that the conservative brain simulates significantly more disgust than the liberal brain. So what we see is that there's a physical neural reaction to disgust metaphor in political discourse that is significantly stronger for a conservative mind than it is for a progressive mind. And now it all comes full circle, right? Because now you can see not only why conservatives would be people to rely on this metaphor more when talking about immigration, when talking about taxation, etc., but also does such language have a stronger impact on the conservative mind because of the physical realities of the conservative brain.
And this basically just has to do with the way they were raised. And what's also interesting to me is that, or the way we were raised too, Trump seemed to use a lot of those words, is sort of, and that was again going back to your bet. You were just noticing that he used a lot of words like disgusting and filthy and stuff like that when he was running.
Well, what we saw in Donald Trump's campaign is something that we've been able to see in many, many discourses across the globe and also throughout history, where it does tend to be the case, and now we know that that's for good reason, it tends to be the case that more conservative politicians will rely on purity or disgust language and imagery more heavily than their opponents. And yes, we did see this absolutely in the Trump campaign. Trump talked about the incident where Hillary Clinton took a restroom break, right? He talked about this to great length. He said, oh, this is disgusting. I don't even want to think about it. Oh, let's not talk about it. It's so disgusting. It's awful, right? Now you ask yourself, why would a candidate even decide to bring up this topic, right? Well, he did because for him, the purity concern kind of extends to the political battle. And he, you know, decide, you know, whether he planned it or he just did it because that's the way he's wired, he did use this domain to talk about his political opponents. He talked about the fact that Marco Rubio was sweating so much and so on. And then, of course, I mean, this is just his opponents during the election campaigns. Now, when you also think about the way in which he talked about political issues such as immigration, right? He was using the same disgust or purity metaphors and actually disease metaphors to think about immigration, for instance, from Mexico into America. And he talked about, drugs poisoning the bloodstream of the nation, etc. So you can really, you can see how he used this type of language extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And then, final point, he also did talk about himself as somebody who's very, very concerned with purity and cleanliness. He talked about the fact that he doesn't like to shake hands.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the fact that he washes his hands very frequently. So, and again, whether this is political strategy during a campaign or whether this is Donald Trump who, you know, for good reason ran for the conservative party, whether it's intended or not, whether it's just him or whether it's a strategy, in a way it doesn't matter because anybody who similarly reacts to purity language and purity metaphors when reasoning about political issues such as immigration is going to relate to this, is going to react to that, and is going to be very invested in the issue once you make it an issue of purity.
And this is probably why, even though he's having a really hard time politically in terms of the whole, you know, what was going on with the firing of James Comey and this and that, his base doesn't seem to care. They seem to be really supporting him. I guess I've read numbers as high as in the high 80s, but at least over 80% are still supporting him. And you think it's just because he comes across, as you say, as a disgusted big daddy who's working on his own purity and that kind of thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more complex than that. But these two parts of President Trump's communication and, you know, his own reasoning, you know, they are very, very strong motivators for his base and people that support him, because they can relate to it, because people do not relate to single political issues. People do not relate to facts and figures and so on and so forth in and of themselves. They relate to somebody's values and morality. So when they have a candidate back in the time, or now a president, who very authentically, in many ways, embodies a strict perspective on society, really strict perspective, you know, where, you know, Trump will say, you know, what's right and what's wrong. You know, he will say, oh, something is so sad, so sad, so sad. Or he will give Mike Pence, you know, a 10 on a scale from 0 to 10. He had said at some point, you know, Mike Pence is doing a great job. He's a 10, etc. So him over and over embodying this strict, you know, father figure, if you want, really reassures his voters that this is exactly whom they voted into office, and mm-hmm. for good reason. And not because of single issues or details, but because of the general moral worldview that he stands for, which they share.
And in your book, or actually I read somewhere online that you had said that that a lot of this too, the repetition, even negation, is a big part of it. And you also talked about all of this, as you were saying a little earlier, in terms of frames or political frames, and I guess moral political frames. But frames have been around a long time. I know that George Lakoff wrote a book about it probably over 10 years ago. But the Republicans seem to get frames and very well, and it seems that liberals don't as well, although I'm beginning to think that Bernie Sanders was able to talk in terms of moral values and possibly frames. Could you talk a little about that and why we don't understand frames and what we do need to understand?
Well, so let's briefly talk about what you brought up with the repetition of language. Whenever a message is repeated in discourse, it gets stronger in people's minds. This process is called Hebbian learning, named after Donald Hebb, who first found out about this. And essentially, every time you hear something, it becomes strengthened in your mind. So after a while, it turns into your commonsensical reasoning, if you want. You stop questioning the idea. It just turns into some sort of truth. And this is why, for instance, it's very important in election campaigns to, you know, rather than going for linguistic diversity and saying the same thing in many different ways, which is, by the way, something a, you know, rhetoric coach would probably advise people to do. You know, don't always use the same words. Well, mm-hmm. actually, the opposite is true. Use the same words, use your slogans, say what you think and what you mean over and over and over again to get through to the minds of your fellow citizens. Second point you made, frame negation. This is a huge, huge pitfall in political communication. Very often, politicians, instead of proactively formulating what they believe in, what their moral goals are for society, buy linguistically and thus conceptually into the frames of their opponents because they communicate in a defensive manner. So take Hillary Clinton as one example during the election campaigns. When Trump came forth and he talked about the woman card and that, you know, Hillary had the woman card, her campaign went on to print a woman card. People were able to order it online. Generally speaking, everybody was very happy about this. It seemed at the time like, you know, a great success. You know, some money got raised and people said, oh, I'm going to purchase the woman card. I'm going to use it in everyday life, you know, to get extra privileges. Now, what happened, though, is that Hillary Clinton's campaign had tapped into the pitfall of frame negation. They took the frame that Donald Trump had set, and they repeated it over and over and over again. And so they enhanced it in people's minds. And then at the end of the day, what you're left with is that somehow the issue of, you know, women making it to certain points in their lives because they get extra privilege to overcome whatever, you know, areas where they have been not privileged in the past, that whole idea, this whole notion was propagated at that point also by Hillary Clinton's campaign. And this is a very good example for you for frame negation. And to give you a more everyday example, if I say to you now, or, you know, to our listeners, I say now, don't think of Barack Obama. You have to think of Barack Obama in order to do what I'm asking you to do. And this shows you it's simply not possible for people to not think. If you are asked to negate an idea, you have to bring up the idea first.
Right. And
so
that
frame negation is a huge issue.
It seems like that also creates stronger and stronger synaptic connections in our brains. And you talked about that. But I also want to go back to Will and Liz, because this book can be yours, Elizabeth Whaling's book on how this political divide is created in our unconscious and what we can start to do about it. Will and Liz, are you there? And help?
We certainly are.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Stephanie. And a fascinating subject we're talking about. I think Dr. Joseph Goebbels covered this quite a while back, but that's another story. I recommend picking up the phone and dialing 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266.
I can't take him anywhere, folks. I'm
you really
sorry.
Can't. You can dress me up, but you sure shouldn't put me on the mic. Don't you agree, Liz?
I totally do. But you can become a member of KBOO and pick up a copy of Elizabeth Whaling's book, Your Brain's Politics, How the Science of Mind Explains the Political Divide. And that book can be yours for a $75 membership contribution that comes to $6.25 a month. It goes into great detail and elaborates on all of these really interesting points that she's been bringing up over the course of this interview. And, she, of course, in the book, she's able to go in much greater depth than we're able to do here. So if you find this conversation fascinating, I have to say I do for sure.
Me too.
Take a moment, become a member, 877-500-5266, and pick up a copy of the books. It's a win-win situation.
How many of those books do we have?
We only have five.
Only five?
Only five! And we might have given some
only
away already.
Left.
Only three left.
Only
oh,
three
oh,
left.
Well, okay, well, so, you know, now's the time. It's 11:40. We've only got 20 minutes left in this program. It's the last day of our membership drive as well for spring 2017. So this is your final opportunity to support Stephanie's program, The Recovery Zone. And it's your last opportunity to pick up a copy of this book and show your support for KBOO. What are you waiting for? 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
That's right. Grasp the moment firmly and pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. You can also donate online. That's super simple. Just turn on your computer. Well, not turn on it like it's your enemy. I mean, anyway.
Take that, computer. Take
yes.
it.
It's easy to donate at kboo.fm. But also, the way I recommend, this is how I became a volunteer, is come on down to the station. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, just off Burnside. Super easy to find. We've got a beautiful mural up front. Come in, have a cup of coffee, and see where your money goes. Check out the community radio station that you're listening to right now. But if you don't have time for that, please pick up the phone, dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. We have some gorgeous volunteers sitting by the phones, eager to answer them.
And very pleasantly smelling, too.
All of them?
All of them.
Wow.
And there goes the phone. That's great. So, Elizabeth, we've got we have 7 minutes left to keep talking about this. And another question that I had was, well, it sounds like that there's almost no room for facts, but you had something in the book that facts can be used, but they need to be used against a kind of a moral frame or a moral backdrop. And could you talk about that a little bit?
Correct. So if you think about it, if you think about it, really, any political proposal, any policy proposal, stems from a moral contestation of the issue. So even before politicians talk to us about factual information and what they want to do about it, right? So what are they going to make of the facts? How are they going, you know, where do they see the source of the problem? Where do they see the solution, etc.? They came to the facts with a moral perspective, with their ideology. And so whatever policy they derive is already based on the moral premises of their political work. And so in communication, you know, let's say you come up with a policy proposal based on the moral premises of who you are as a political being, as a politician, then you derive a policy proposal and then you want to talk to the public about this policy proposal. Why on earth drop all the morality from your communication which got you to make this proposal in the first place? Why on earth go out there and talk facts, 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 and policy, policy, policy in an abstract manner as if you had never brought morality to the table in the first place, right? So this is a mistake we see very often, that when it comes to communicating with a fellow citizen about what you want to do politically, that you drop the moral premises of your proposals. And this is a huge problem, because just the way in which you derived your solutions from morality, does your fellow citizen agree or not agree with the solutions based on their morality? So you find common ground in moral cognition, not in factual information in and of itself. So while facts are central to politics, very, very important, core, you do need to talk about what you make of the facts from a moral perspective.
So, like,
and
for
unfortunately,
instance,
that is where sometimes we fall short.
I'm just thinking, like, global warming. I think the Pope was doing it, or the climate change. It's about, if we really care about the planet, you know, we start from that premise, you know, and care about life on Earth.
Yeah, and Pope Francis is doing a great job with moral framing, by the way.
Yeah, I got that feeling. And I got the feeling that Bernie was doing it, too.
Absolutely. And Elizabeth Warren is doing it as well.
And that actually what I read somewhere that 60% of Americans actually support the more, you know, support kind of more liberal positions. But again, they seem to get more co-opted by, like, say, a word like tax relief, or a phrase like tax relief,
mm-hmm.
becomes the frame. Then is that you're getting relieved from having to pay taxes? Like, it's a right. Tax relief is a frame, actually, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That phrase.
Yeah, it is. Tax relief is a frame because it makes taxation implicitly understood as a burden, something that's inherently negative and damaging. Right? Nobody wants to have a burden. Everybody wants relief. I mean, if I were to ask you now, please write down the first five things that come to mind when you think about the word relief, you would say something like, you know, like sighing,
right,
and happiness, etc. So it's an inherently positive concept from everyday life. Now what you do is you take this very positive everyday concept, you use it via metaphor to cognize taxation and what happens. You're implicitly telling your audience over and over and over again that taxes are a negative thing and no taxes are a positive thing, where, you know, of course, if we had no taxes, we would have no bridges and roads and all kinds of stuff that we need and rely on for our personal freedom and, you know, and also economic well-being on an everyday basis. So this is framing. And giving you another example, climate change. You mentioned climate change as we talked about Pope Francis. Think about what change means in everyday life. I can change for the better, or I can change for the worse. So change is inherently non-moral. There is no threat inferred. There is no problem inferred. All we're saying is that, oh, look, the climate is changing.
Right.
Right? So this type of language makes it very hard for people who want to fight climate change, who want to protect the environment and thus society, to get across what they really care about deeply, deeply, because they keep using language very often, very frequent, actually, for the environmental issue. They keep using language that doesn't communicate what they are concerned with. For instance, a worsening of the climate, or, you know, a real, real threat to our nature and to our planet, if you want. So these are the exact moments where people should be looking at the language very carefully, take what's being said, think about what it means in everyday life, and then come back to the political issue and say, oh, wait a moment, I'm not sure that I want to imply all of this. Maybe what I'm really trying to say is this.
Right, right. Well, we just have like a minute left. Do you have a last thought before before we sign off?
Well, I think maybe because this comes up quite a bit, and you mentioned it too, or you at least alert to it, the question of whether there's something inherent to conservatism and liberalism that makes it easier for conservatives to come up with strong moral frames. And that is not the case. That's a myth. Any person who has strong political beliefs, which everybody does, both the left and the right, is capable of finding a language that makes these strong moral concerns transparent to the fellow citizens. Is it work? Yes. Does it not happen overnight? No. But it's possible for everybody to do. And at the end of the day, a good democratic discourse has to rely on everybody saying exactly what they care about. So not taking that extra step and making sure over and over that you use a language that makes your values transparent actually can mean that you're kind of failing your democratic mandate, you know, to tell your fellow citizens what you are about and where you want to be headed with this country. So to have a healthy, democratic, transparent, honest discourse, or battle even, everybody needs to say what they truly believe in the most transparent, direct, and simple way possible in order for us to then, you know, debate.
Yeah, transparency, ultimately, with where you're really, really coming from. I want to thank you, Elizabeth, for being on the show. Listeners, you've been hearing from Elizabeth Whaling, who's co-author with George Lakoff of Your Brain's Politics, How the Science of Mind Explains the Political Divide. And this book can be had if you make a financial contribution to KBOO Radio for only $75. It can be yours. And this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. I'm Stephanie Potter, and Will and Elizabeth, or Liz, are still here to talk about how you can support KBOO Radio, which is totally about morality and politics and making things better and saving our world. Are you guys there?
We are indeed. And the way you can make things better for us here at KBOO and for you as part of our radio community is to go to your phone and call 877-500-5266. Speaking of having strong feelings and thoughts and wanting to communicate them in the most transparent way possible, here you go. This is the last day of our Spring Membership Drive 2017. It's your last opportunity to support Stephanie Potter's program, The Recovery Zone. It's your last opportunity in this hour to show your support for your community radio station. So pick up the phone right now, 877-500-5266. It's also your last opportunity to pick up a copy of Elizabeth Whaling's book, The Brain's Politics, How Science of the Mind Explains the Political Divide, which, as Stephanie mentioned, can be yours for a $75 membership. That comes to just $6.25 per month, $6.25 per month. Our volunteers are standing by to take your call and explain the whole process. It's safe, it's quick, it's secure, and you get to support and invest in your community radio. I just want to say, too, I think one of the things I believe in personally, most strongly, is the concept of community. It's through strong community that people can get things done that they couldn't possibly do as individuals. KBOO exemplifies that. We've been doing that for almost 50 years, and we want to continue doing it for another 50 years, but we can't do it without your support. So go to the phone right now, 877-500-5266.
That's right. It's so important that you do that. You put the you into community, and without you, it's just community, and that doesn't make any sense. So please pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. There are other ways to donate or contribute and pledge your support. You can come on down to the radio station. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Beautiful mural up front, very easy to find. We're just off Burnside. You can come in, have a cup of coffee, get a tour of the station, and see where your money goes and what this how this radio station functions. It's full of eager and enthusiastic staff members and volunteers. And it's a great place to be. I've been volunteering here about 9 years, and I get as much out of it as I put in, because it's a great place, fascinating conversations.
Oh, I get more out of it than I put in.
Oh, I don't. But it's lots of learning opportunities at this great radio station, and it's a vital part of Portland. I've been listening to this radio station since 93 when I moved to this town, and it's been around for almost 50 years. And you have to place a value on something that's invaluable. Check your wallet. See how much you can afford to keep this radio station on the air and thriving by dialing 877 877- 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KABU. I want to thank Stephanie for her great show and fascinating interview. And we do still have a few copies of that very interesting book about neuroscience and the language of politics and the politics of language. Call up, pledge your support, and get a copy of this book by dialing 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KABU. Isn't that right, Liz?
That is right. 80% of our operating budget comes from individual contributions from listeners just like you. So when we tell you that we need to bring in another $22,000 today to make our membership drive goal, don't panic. If enough of you call up, and enough of you will, I have every confidence, that we will make that goal. We're not asking one person to pony up $22,000. We want 10 of you at $10 a month, or 20 of you at $5 a month, or 50 of you at $100 a month, whatever amount works for you. We are asking you to put a financial value on what KABU Community Radio means to you. This is your community radio. It's not my community radio. It's not Will's community radio.
It's
ours.
Oh, okay.
It's ours. It's all of ours. And it only exists with your support.
That's 877-500-5266.
Just by the way, speaking of Stephanie's program, The Recovery Zone, which she has been doing now for about 9 years on the air, did you know that 7,500 total hours per year of local programming is produced right here at KABU?
Zoinks!
Zoinks, indeed. Zooms. It's amazing. We can't do that kind of programming without your help, without the trainings of the volunteers give to one another so that we can learn how to produce quality, interesting radio programs for you. And without the money that we pay for our transmitter and tower rental.
And electricity.
Without the money for our utilities, without the money to pay for our very hardworking staff and the over 500 volunteers who give of their time to keep the station going. You can become a part of that right now. 877-500-5266. That number again, Will, say it with me. 877-500-5266. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Elizabeth. You know what? I realize we have 2 more minutes to go.
So, oh, great. Let's
yeah.
Them.
So one little quickie thing. I know that Lakoff, when he first was thinking about all this, came up with the idea. A friend had asked him to just, what's a one-sentence word to describe whether or not you're on the left or the right? And a psychologist said a question could be, when a baby cries at night, do you pick him up? And I thought that was just very interesting in terms of just one simple little question to just sort of describe this difference. And is there like a way that people could just sort of like look at their own thought bubbles to start realizing how they think that way?
Well, I mean, so absolutely what George's friend said at the time, and this is many years, and by the way, if you want to read up on the strict and nurturing family models and how they came about and what the details are, in addition to the book that George and I have out now, Your Brain's Politics, and also our shared book, The Little Blue Book, he has a fantastic book from 1996 called Moral Politics, How Conservatives and Liberals Think. And he goes in great detail through a lot of the very important groundwork that he has been doing on this issue. And yes, one of the ways in which he kind of, you know, realized what you needed to do in order to truly understand how people make moral judgments in politics, that you need to look at family values really to understand what's going on, came from this very conversation you just brought up, where his friend said, well, George, you know, ask people, when your baby cries at night, do you pick him up? And the answer to that question essentially tells you, are you more of a strict family person or a nurturing family person? Strict family person would say, let him cry himself to sleep, right?
Yeah.
The world is tough. He needs to be strong and call, you know, soothe himself. And the nurturing family person would say, well, you know, pick him up, give him, you know, calm him down, give him love and all these things. So really that was the genius of that question. And it led to this fantastic, very, very deep, rich work around how family ideals translate into political ideals. Now, because this question covers the very basics of what political moral cognition is about, it's very hard to think of any other question that will get you the same richness of, you know, of answers to who you are politically. So my advice to your listeners would be, you know, ask yourself that question. What are your family values? And then look at how that translates into your political values and action. And very often, by the way, people who are quote-unquote not political and who have no political beliefs simply haven't yet consciously translated their family ideals onto politics. So one way to get people more involved in political matters and political discourse is to make it very, very clear to them that we all have moral judgment about right and wrong. We all have ideas about what the ideal family and ideal parenting looks like. Well, translate those things to the nation, and you have a very clear answer to what you think the nation should look like and governance should look like. So bringing the everyday ideology into politics can be hugely impactful in getting people to engage with politics in a way that they might not do right now.
Right, which would bring more of that giant 60% majority to start making their voice heard. And it would, it seems like so critical at this point to get more and more of us involved. Again, I wanted to say you've been listening to Elizabeth Whalen, co-author with George Lakoff of Your Brain's Politics, How the Science of Mind Explains the Political Divide. And this is the Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world in a myriad of different ways, anything from like how we farm to what are we doing about nuclear weapons to how we think about things, you know, happiness in schools instead of money. A lot of different shows that you can support with a contribution to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. I just want to thank you for listening, and thank you, Elizabeth, for being on my show.
Oh, thanks. It was a pleasure.
Great.
Time and time again, they seem to come through with what you want to hear. Luckily, you don't need to invest the time and effort of space travel to hear this kind of programming. We're right here on Earth, we're KBOO, and just a $40 pledge will help keep us on the air.
A little tidbit from the KBOO Archives.